Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Governor Ron DeSantis has shown himself to be uniquely skilled at attracting attention to himself well beyond the borders of Florida, his home state. He's willing to pick a fight with just about anyone to grab a headline. Reporters, health officials, teachers, even Mickey Mouse. Just this month, he blocked state funds for the Tampa Bay Rays stadium when players tweeted in support of gun control in the wake of the slaughter in Uvalde. And he's trying to punish the Disney Corporation for criticizing Florida's so-called Don't Say Gay law. Staff writer Dexter Filkins has been reporting from Florida and looking in to see whether Ron DeSantis is the potential heir to Trump or maybe his biggest political opponent. Dexter, right now we're watching the January 6th hearings, and at the same time, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, is making a lot of noise as a politician. Is it very likely that he's the number one contender behind Trump to inherit the mantle of the Republican Party?
Yeah, I think so. All the polls suggest that if Trump doesn't run, DeSantis is in pole position, and he's ready. I mean, he's got, you know, more than $100 million in the bank, and he practically radiates ambition.
Well, let's talk a little bit about his background. Who is Ron DeSantis? Where does he come from? What kind of person is he?
He's from Florida. He was born in Jacksonville. He grew up outside of Tampa in a town called Dunedin. And it's a working class neighborhood. Working class guy, went to public school. He was a great baseball player in Little League, where they won the World Series, and in high school. And he went to Yale on a baseball scholarship, and then on to Harvard Law School. So he's come a long way.
Did he distinguish himself academically at Yale and then Harvard Law?
He did. In fact, one of the more funny quotes that I got from one of his former classmates at Yale was, "Ron was so smart that we couldn't plagiarize off of his papers because everyone would know where it came from because he's the only one that smart who could have made that argument."
He's smart in what way?
More than a couple of people told me his memory is practically photographic, and particularly when I was having conversations about the coronavirus, that he was reading medical journals, and he'd read them once, he would digest it, he would understand it, and could have a conversation about it. Like, he's very, very fast.
How would you describe Ron DeSantis ideologically, and how did he become that way?
It's hard to tell how much of Ron DeSantis is ideological and how much is opportunism. He sounds like Trump, except that he speaks in complete sentences. And he's very, very articulate and very, very quick. But he's competing for the same constituency. So he's very, very angry at the elites, even though he went to Harvard and Yale. He's very angry at Washington. He's very angry at the politicians. And so he's kind of rallying basically the white working class of Florida, of which the numbers are still quite large, and he's angry.
And we're going to make sure that parents are able to send their kid to kindergarten without having some of this stuff injected into their school curriculum.
How did he become governor? My understanding is that although he's now seen as the dominant political figure in state politics, obviously Trump himself is in Palm Beach, that DeSantis really kind of, he squeaked by to get in.
He squeaked by. He did. I think he won by less than 1%. And I think there was at least one recount, automatic recount. He defeated a politician named Andrew Gillum, who had been the mayor of Tallahassee. Very, very close race. And I think he benefited from the fact that Gillum, not only was he black in a state, former Confederacy, but also because Gillum came from the left of the party, and Gillum had squeaked in and sort of beaten a moderate to get the nomination against Gwen Graham, who many people believed would have fared much better against DeSantis. But DeSantis won just by a hair, but he's been a missile going straight up ever since.
What do you mean?
He has developed a style, which is very visible, very theatrical, again, very angry, but it has made him a national politician. And he really built, over the last couple of years, he really built himself and his persona, and I hate to use the word brand, but it's a brand, around the way that he dealt with the coronavirus. And essentially, it played in perfectly for him and his style, because he could say, I don't agree with Fauci and all the pinheads in Washington, and all they want to do is oppress you and make you wear masks and keep your children at home. And so he charted this very, very novel course on the coronavirus, and that's what made him famous.
Now, the COVID policy that you describe is not just, you know, sheer obstinate ignorance. We've seen some of that in political quarters in the last few years, but something a little bit more complicated.
I had a long conversation with a professor at Stanford of public health, an epidemiologist named Jay Bhattacharya, who said he was sitting at home one day on a Sunday, and his phone rang, and it was Ron DeSantis, and he wanted to talk about the coronavirus. And Bhattacharya, very much like DeSantis, were kind of charting a slightly different course. And basically, and I'm going to make this a little crude, but it's essentially masking doesn't really work. The only thing you can really do is protect the elderly, which DeSantis did from the get-go, protect the elderly and basically try to ride the virus out until a vaccine comes. But don't kid yourself, there's not that much that we can do about it. And so what followed from that, naturally, was keep the schools open, keep the government offices open, keep the beaches open, keep the shopping malls open, and that's what Florida did. Very, very different from, say, New York or California.
And so I think the question is we can either have a free society or we can have a biomedical security state. And I can tell you, Florida, we're a free state.
And how are its statistics?
That's very, very interesting. I mean, kind of, you know, they went up and down and up and down, and he caught a lot of hell over the course of the pandemic. But today, in 2022, the numbers aren't bad. I mean, he's kind of, Florida is in the middle when you look at death rates. It's pretty much in the middle of the pack, right next to California. So, you know, California shut down their entire economy, all their schools for 2 years. Florida kept everything open. So he's looking better than he did.
Now, another issue that's been crucial to his presence on the national scene is LGBTQ issues and how they're taught in schools. DeSantis has been out front on that. He passed a law a couple of months ago called the Parental Rights in Education, or the so-called Don't Say Gay law, where he supported it. What's the deal there? Tell me what happened and what role DeSantis plays there.
Well, I think, again, DeSantis has become a master at picking these issues that get everyone excited.
Hot-button cultural issues.
Super hot-button, yeah. And he's very, very good at sort of staking out a position and kind of pounding the table and saying, I'm not giving in to the liberals in the Northeast.
One of the stunning things about this episode is that DeSantis goes to war against a huge company in a state, against Disney.
It's remarkable. And he appears not to have suffered for it politically, not yet.
So describe the fight and what was the outcome?
So they hate it when you say the Don't Say Gay law, but that's how everybody understands it now, so I'm going to use that. The legislature passes the law. He signs it. Disney's response initially in Orlando, Disney World, is tepid. And the employees, many employees at Disney World got angry at their CEO and said, this isn't enough. Like, we hate this. And so then the CEO came forward and condemned DeSantis and condemned the law. And then DeSantis basically went after Disney. And, you know, Disney, since it was built in the late 1960s, has basically had its own, basically it governs itself. If there's a fire at Disney World, Disney World has to put out the fire.
And they have special accommodations in some ways.
Yeah, very. And they govern themselves, essentially. They are left alone. And DeSantis just took that and threatened to zero out the entire special district for Disney World, which would be an upheaval in that part of the state. I mean, not least among the local governments that suddenly would have to put out the fires in Disney World. Taxes would go up. I mean, it would be an upheaval. And he threatened to do it, and Disney got quiet. Not completely, but DeSantis didn't suffer for it, and it's just remarkable. And when you talk to ordinary, say ordinary voters or people, his supporters, that's what they love about him. You know, they would say, you know, any other politician would have caved into Disney. you know, would have backed down and said, I'm so sorry, and not Ron.
So what's the purpose of the law in the first place?
I hate to speculate as to his motives, but it made a lot of headlines all across the country. And I think just the kind of headlines that he wants to make.
Which are what?
Which is, when you see him speak, he says, I'm anti-woke, I'm anti-elites, I'm against the press, I'm against the pinhead politicians in Washington. And so he can position himself as very much as a kind of anti-elitist. He doesn't really need to do all that in Florida to win. I mean, he's got that constituency locked up anyway.
So it's all national politics.
That's what it seems like. I mean, I think every person I talk to who knows him says this is a deeply ambitious man, and he has had... He's had his eyes on the White House since he was in college, and that every job he had was basically a stepping stone to the next one.
So you knocked on a lot of doors in the state of Florida in pursuit of a really deep piece on Ron DeSantis. One of the doors you knocked on was on the door of the father of Ron DeSantis. Describe that encounter.
Well, you know, I had just come from the CPAC conference in Orlando where Ron Jr. spoke, pounding the table. And I thought
it's the Conservative Political Action Committee.
Yeah. It's the big gathering. And so I drove to Dunedin, the little town where they still live. I looked up his address. He was there. I pulled over into a McDonald's and like changed into a nice put out like a white shirt on and long pants. And I went with absolutely no expectation of success. I went and knocked on the door. And it's
as we learned to do as young reporters many years ago.
Yeah, you think there's no way he's going to come out and talk to me. He probably won't even be there. And lo and behold, he did. And he was wearing an FSU T-shirt. Looked like he hadn't shaved in a couple of days. Barefoot, shorts. Nicest guy in the world. I mean, absolutely, really nice. Didn't really want to talk to me at first. Said I'm a little suspicious. I'll be frank with you. But then we had a really nice talk about his son.
How did he characterize him?
He said more than once. He said, "Well, Ron is stubborn," and he told a very funny story about him, which was, you know, Ron's a very good baseball player, and my gosh, I must have thrown 500,000 pitches to him when he was young, right out there in the front yard, and I think he only swung at 500 of them.
He likes to walk. In terms of character, the guy you describe here is not exactly a winning personality in the standard sense. There's a moment that you describe in the piece where DeSantis is sparring with the CNN reporter named Rosa Flores over the vaccine rollout in Florida.
What has gone wrong with the rollout of the vaccine that we've seen phone lines jammed, websites crashing?
It's a lot of demand. I mean, I think at the end of the day,
if I could finish my question.
You just said what has gone wrong, so I'm answering the question.
If I could complete the question, though.
So are you going to give a speech or are you going to ask a question?
With all due respect, Governor,
you asked the question. I'm going
to
answer it.
I'm trying to finish my question.
No, you're giving a speech. You asked the question.
I am trying to ask you the...
You're going to ask how many questions? You get three? They only got one question. Why do you get three?
With all due respect, Governor, I'm just asking if I could finish my question.
You didn't. You finished the question.
I did not. My full question is, what went wrong with the rollout of the vaccine when we've seen phone lines jammed, websites
crashing?
So you're
repeating your question.
To complete it for you, Governor, we've seen websites crash and also senior citizens waiting overnight for the vaccine.
Where was that at?
We've seen it in Duval, Broward, Orange, and Lee County.
And why was, like, in Lee, why did that happen? Did you investigate
why? That's my question to you, Governor. You're the governor of the state. I'm not the governor of the state.
Okay, but you didn't investigate why that happened, like, in Lee County. Why was there a big line? Did you investigate why?
Could you tell us why?
Because we distributed vaccine to hospitals, and the hospital said, first come, first serve. If you show up, we'll do it. So they didn't use a registration system. There wasn't anything that was done. And there's a lot of demand for it. So people are going to want to go ahead and get it.
So are you saying there was no plan then from the state to make sure that senior citizens didn't wait outside overnight?
So the state is not dictating to hospitals how, we're not dictating to Carlos Montoya how he runs his operations here. That would be a total disaster. These guys are much more competent to be able to deliver healthcare services than a state government.
God, that's amazing. What struck you about that moment, Dex?
Well, he won't let up. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. And he keeps interrupting her, and he will not let her finish, and he will not let her ask the question. And he doesn't stop. I mean, it just, he must have interrupted her 15 times. And I think the key to that is he knows he's not going to get CNN. He doesn't care about CNN. And what does he care about? He cares about, you know, imagine a typical Trump voter watching that on TV saying, man, beat up the CNN reporter. Right. You know, this is great. Stick it to them. And I think he's got that down to a science.
Well, and Fox has had a huge role in DeSantis's ascent. You did a public records request and got a lot of emails between Fox News and DeSantis's office. What did you learn from those emails?
It's pretty amazing. It's basically a symbiotic relationship. It's kind of, you know, DeSantis needs Fox to become a national figure. Fox needs somebody to replace Trump. They kind of find each other. And so over the course of the emails, they're each suggesting programs to the other. They're practically writing the questions for each other. They're saying, God, that was great. You know, we should make you a host of our show. And so it is so close that, you know, the idea of kind of the traditional idea of journalism, which is you keep your distance. Journalists keep their distance from politicians. I mean, that's all gone.
Not so much.
Yeah.
And what's been the impact of his appearances on Fox? Is it quantifiable?
I think so. It's quantifiable in the polls, which are he is now far ahead of any other potential Republican nominee for the presidential election. And I think that's with the exception of Trump. And there is some speculation that he may actually run against Trump if Trump doesn't drop out.
What's that relationship like?
I think the most positive characterization I got of it was that it was complicated. They have a complicated relationship.
That means, in English, that means they hate each other.
I think so. As I was told, Trump believes, with some justification, that he created DeSantis. He endorsed him during the primary, and DeSantis, who had been far behind, kind of just took off and won the nomination. And so I think former President Trump expects a little bit of deference and a little bit more gratitude than he's been getting from DeSantis. As somebody put it to me, Ron refuses to kiss his ring.
Or anything else. If you had to pick one moment or one scene in the governor's career that exemplifies his political stature, his importance, the way he comports himself, what might it be?
I think it would be actually the moment with the CNN reporter. That's it in a nutshell.
What about the scene where he kind of yelled at a kid? Remember this?
That's a remarkable scene. He was going to Tampa to announce, I think, you know, greater funding for cybersecurity education. And so he gets up on the podium and there's like a line of kids behind him, college kids, and they've all got masks on. And DeSantis turns to them without cracking a smile. I mean, there's no irony. And he says, take your masks off. And he talks about, I've had enough COVID theater.
You do not have to wear those masks. I mean, please take them off. Honestly, it's not doing anything, and we got to stop with this COVID theater. So if you want to wear it, fine, but this is ridiculous.
He's angry. He's like actually angry at these kids. And you can hear kind of nervous laughter in the background. Like people are like, wow, is the governor joking? And when it becomes clear that he's not joking, some of the kids take their masks off. They don't know what to do.
And this is a winning strategy?
That's the thing. I mean, you have to ask yourself, does anger, how many angry candidates have been elected president of the United States? Yeah, I can think of one.
Dexter, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Staff writer Dexter Filkins. His profile of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis appears in this week's New Yorker. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hi, it's David Remnick. As the 2024 election draws near, it's more important than ever to understand exactly what's happening in American politics. The New Yorker offers definitive reporting and analysis by some of the best writers and political thinkers watching the campaign. Commentators and reporters, including Susan Glasser, Jane Mayer, Jelani Cobb, Masha Gessen, Evan Osnos, Ben Wallace Wells, and many more are providing incisive analysis that you don't want to miss. Subscribers get unlimited access to all of it. And we're offering a deal just for podcast listeners, 15% off a yearly digital subscription. Visit newyorker.com and use the code POD15. That's POD15 for 15% off a digital subscription to The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's June, and that means that a lot of us are attending some weddings, maybe even having a wedding. Still, the rate of marriage remains at historic lows, and the median age for marrying continues to rise. That can cause some real anxiety, both for sociologists and for single people who might like to settle down. The Radio Hour's Kalalea has been looking at a project to alleviate some of that anxiety. It came out of an economics class in Stanford University, and it's called The Marriage Pact.
Hi, I'm Katie.
And I'm Miguel.
Katie and Miguel are the same age, 23.
And I am just under a month older.
Yeah, I'm also 23. Yeah, we're the same star sign, if that makes a difference. But
Pisces, I think.
Yeah, we're both Pisces. Yeah.
Katie and Miguel met while in college around Valentine's Day, just about a year and a half ago. But they've done a whole lot together in a short amount of time.
We went hiking and camping in Acadia, Maine.
That was our first big trip.
That was our first trip that we took together. New Hampshire.
We've been to New Hampshire skiing. We've been to New York City twice.
Yeah, that was so fun because we wanted to go and
we did it. It was great.
Just for fun.
It was a great day. We went to Florida to visit her parents. We went to Costa Rica.
And we went to Ireland.
And then we went to, it was actually right around our anniversary.
Yep.
Just to see a soccer game.
And that was like 7-8 days of traveling together and being
together.
And
we got a rental car in Ireland driving on the other side of the road.
That was wild.
It's clear they're in love or deep, deep like.
Yeah, he's my boyfriend, best friend, and hopefully going to be my life partner.
100%. She is my best friend. She is my life partner and my travel partner.
When people ask you, how did you guys meet? What do you say?
I am usually a little bit embarrassed to answer this question. So I usually would say, oh, we met like in an online dating survey. And whenever I tell people that it's called the Marriage Pact, because that's a big word. Yeah.
I'm not embarrassed by it, but it's definitely like a little bit of a quirky way, I think, to have met.
Yeah.
Something wild is happening at my college, and I'm here to give you all the tea about it. So I think
the Marriage Pact first came to my attention a couple of years ago. One afternoon, I noticed a message similar to this TikTok post.
Marriage Pact. So what this is you like take a survey about yourself that's like 50 questions or something that's almost like a dating profile. And then they match you with someone who's supposed to be the person you make a marriage pact with. Like if we're not with someone by the time we're 45, we're so compatible that we should get married. And there has been some like good PR for this. I'll give them that. But the wild thing
is— I once made a pact with a good friend long, long ago. I'm sure you've made such a pact. He and I agree that if we're still single at the age of 40, then we would get together. He probably didn't take it seriously, but I remember finding comfort in knowing that there'd be someone I bonded with who was willing to be with me as I grew old and crusty. But this marriage pact, It's a lot bigger, more public, more organized.
My name is Liam McGregor, and I started the Marriage Pact. When we sort of looked at the original Marriage Pact, we looked at it and said, okay, you know, you might make a marriage pact with your best friend, but like, what are the odds that your best friend is actually the best person for you to make a marriage pact with?
In 2017, Liam and a classmate designed their own version of a marriage pact survey for an economics class. This survey is done at colleges as a campus-wide event. It happens over the course of 1 week and is promoted mostly by word of mouth. A friend of Katie's convinced her to give it a try.
She's like, oh, you should definitely do this. I was intrigued. I was, when I was filling out the form, very nervous. It does feel very intense when they're asking you your political views, when they're asking you your views on relationships.
It does help you, like, you know, get through some of that. Are we, like, do we actually get along? Do we have, like, similar views? I remember I was like, wow, that's like a really good question.
The Marriage Pact boasts that almost 30% of their matches actually meet up in person, compared to just 1-2% in traditional dating apps. And of those who meet up, 1 in 8 date for 1 year or longer, like Katie and Miguel.
Like, I tried Tinder and I tried Bumble and all those other things, but I don't know. I realized I wasn't good at that kind of online dating. I didn't go in with, like, I'm going to marry whoever my marriage pact is. But I was like, well, it would be kind of nice to get to know someone, like, you know, and to see if we're actually compatible.
The Marriage Pact was launched nearly 5 years ago at Stanford University. And since then, a small team of former undergraduates have released customized surveys at more than 75 universities and colleges. And they say that more than 250,000 students have participated thus far.
I was very much more enthusiastic about doing it than I probably would have been if it weren't for the pandemic and if it weren't for that feeling of isolation and honestly loneliness that I had been feeling like since March of 2020 when I got sent home from school.
Yeah. Are you looking for me? I'm looking for
someone. Where can you be? Using technology to find dates is nothing new. A computer program matching couples launched in 1965. And in the 80s, when divorce rates were increasing and VCRs were in many households, video dating companies sprang up. No more print ads or blind dates. Single people paid these companies hard-earned cash just to find the new love of their life.
Hi, I'm Maurice. I'm an executive by day and a wild man by night.
I'm looking for the goddess. Are you the goddess?
Hi, my name's Mike, and if you're sitting there watching this tape smoking your cigarette, well, hit the fast forward button, because I don't smoke and I don't like people who do smoke.
One of my favorite foods is pizza. And just sugar and spice and all those things that are nice.
I'm not afraid to get sand on my tuxedo if you're not afraid to let the wind mess your hair up a little bit when I take the top down.
And I do consider myself a refined valley dude. Who is the goddess? The goddess is the woman, is a woman, is any woman, is all women.
I like an attractive woman, someone who might look like Christie Brinkley or Jacqueline Smith.
Particularly attracted to black women and women of different races. So if you like me, give me a call.
I decided that I'm lonely, but I'd love to go roller skating.
At the start of the internet boom, there was Match.com. Grindr launched in 2009, Marriage Pact in 2017. Now, personally, I consider myself an expert in old-fashioned matchmaking. I've introduced at least two of my friends to their current spouses. So late in the school year, I took the New Jersey Transit to Princeton University, where the Marriage Pact was taking place over the course of 1 week.
Maddie?
Yeah.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. I'm recording.
Maddie, okay. It's short for Madison, is a sophomore at Princeton.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I thank you for coming.
We walk around until reaching one of the many huge tents set up on the edge of campus. Okay. It's
like, oh, this is good, too.
Yeah, this is also good.
Yeah, because I feel like everything just got really quiet.
Yeah.
Maddie sits on a stack of wood pallets and opens her laptop. This morning, an email went out to all of the Marriage Pact participants. Maddie reads it to me.
Look around. College is the best place to meet the one, but we're not going to be here forever. The Prince and Marriage Pact is here to give you the perfect backup plan. Take our questionnaire and we'll find your best match on campus. We can't promise you a match made in heaven, but we can promise a match made via groundbreaking algorithms and a little linear algebra. Swoon. If someone better comes along in your 20s, more power to you. We hope you don't need us, but better safe than sorry. And then it says that the responses are confidential.
Some of Maddie's friends arrive and they get started. The first few questions are related to identity.
So like gender identity and sexual orientation.
Each question is rated on a scale from 1 to 7. 1 meaning strongly disagree and 7 strongly agree. The questions appear on the screen one at a time.
The next question is, I like drama. No.
Questions that seem pretty straightforward to who you'd like to go on a date with.
I would send back a dish at a restaurant.
I said almost never.
I generally like to take control during sex. Is the next question.
You're nodding.
I think it's an important question. If you guys have competing ideas of like what's going to happen if you do get intimate, then yeah. Like, I don't know, I think that's important.
And then the questions get less obvious and kind of hard.
I'm looking at, I would send older relatives to a nursing home. And I think that's a tough one.
No, I don't know if I would. I don't think I would.
I keep some friends here at Princeton because they'll be useful to me in the future.
That's a good question, especially for people here, I think.
Yeah. Everything will be explained by science. I'd say like a... I'm not a religious person, so I'd say like probably like a 5.
That's what I put.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I consider myself to be an adult.
I feel like I'm at a 5.
After Maddie and her friends leave, I keep thinking about one of the questions. I would keep a gun in the house.
Yeah, so this one I feel like I have more conviction in. I'm strongly disagree.
That's Elizabeth Gerson, who leads operations for the Marriage Pact. She works closely with Liam McGregor, the founder of the pact. Here's Liam again.
It's interesting because we really set out to solve this very specific problem at the beginning, which was, if you need a backup plan for a 50-year-long relationship, who's right for that? And it turns out that a lot of the things that we look for, typically when we look for people to go on first dates with, are really not what matters in the long run, right? You know, it doesn't matter if someone's 5'11 or 6 feet tall if you're going to spend 50 years with them, right? And really, what matters often are these deeply held values and convictions and beliefs, and a strong sense of self that you could never, I mean, personally write down on a profile, let alone, you know, have someone else evaluate. And often there are private things maybe that, you know, do matter for long-term relationships that you might not want to advertise, right? So, I mean, like maybe having a gun in the house is something that you're interested in, but, you know, you don't want that to be your like very first impression of someone or have that be someone's first impression of you.
So on the Marriage Pact website, there's the first paragraph starts off. It says the tools that were meant to bring us together have failed. And then it goes on to say, in fact, existing social tools, broadly speaking, actively make things worse for us. Can one of you elaborate on this?
If you want a short-term relationship, there's really nothing better. There's no more efficient marketplace than the dating apps that are out there today. They're really excellent for solving that thing. But the thing is, because they're the only tools out there, people have tried to use them to solve these other problems as well.
They're not exactly the only tools. But what's interesting to me is that the Marriage Pact is betting on a way of relating that is long-term for a generation of people who are essentially being programmed, if you will, to think short-term.
As a student who was taking it for the first time, it was so refreshing to be given the opportunity where you're not actually filling out a profile, where you genuinely are sitting down for 10, 15, 20 minutes and interrogating basically your deeply held values yourself.
I think another interesting thing is that even though, you know, the Marriage Pact has a very serious word in its title, like you mentioned, Kalalia, it's not always that serious, right? When you're making a backup plan, it's about taking the pressure off of some big institution or some major life decision that maybe you're not ready to make yet. And so I think what we've found is that Marriage Pact exists in this sort of liminal space between commitment and non-commitment.
I thought back to something Maddie had told me that really surprised me. She was so excited about taking the Marriage Pact, even though she's already in a committed relationship with someone who doesn't go to Princeton. She was hoping to make friends because on this campus filled with thousands of interesting people her age, she often feels lonely.
Some of the most lonely times for me have been like recently, I would say. This past Friday and Saturday, it was like one of the first times that I had called my mom and was like, hey, I feel lonely, you know?
You literally said that?
Yeah, well, I called her and we were just talking and then I texted her and I was like, hey, just like, I just called you because I like was lonely and like, because my team had gone to Ivy's, so none of them were on campus and those are the people that I would usually hang out with. So I was kind of just like sitting in one of the upperclassmen's apartments by myself. My boyfriend wasn't there, my other friends weren't there. It was kind of just like, oh, like everyone's doing something fun or like spontaneous and I'm like sitting home by myself watching TikTok.
Was there anything particular your mom said that made you feel better?
Probably just that she was proud of me and how well I was doing. Yeah, and then the next, I guess it was the next day, she and my sister actually came and like surprised me just to like be like, we're here for you, we're always supporting you. So
how did that?
It felt really good, honestly.
After listening to Maddie, my mind wandered back to 5 years ago when public health officials began to warn Americans about the consequences of being so very disconnected.
Former Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy tackled a range of public health crises. They included issues like Zika, drug and alcohol addiction, and obesity. But he also shed light on a silent crisis, the rising number of lonely people in America. He spoke about his
concern. It's easy to blame social media or the internet. But for decades, political scientists like Robert Putnam, for example, called attention to the erosion of civic engagement and the loss of collective activities for Americans that's been going on really since the 1950s. He calls it the bowling alone syndrome.
You can't go to a bowling league by yourself unless other people go. That's what it means to be a league. And that's, no, that's a fundamental, deep fundamental point here. This problem of social capital is something that you can't produce entirely by yourself, but we've got to do it together. And so part of what I'm trying to do, and other people, obviously there are a lot of other people talking about the loss of community in America, part of what we're trying to do is to say loudly, look, we all feel this way, why don't we just get together more often?
I definitely heard a lot of talk about like being lonely and having these lulls and there's, you know, these sort of gaps in the pandemic bringing on a certain amount of loneliness that I think we're seeing all over the country, actually. So what have you learned about like the epidemic of loneliness?
Wow, that's a big question. I think maybe I'll share a little statistic and then I think Liz probably has a much better perspective on this.
No.
So I'd love to hear what she has to
say.
Go
for it.
10 to 20% of the people who participate in the Marriage Pact are already in long-term committed relationships. And that kind of surprised me on the one hand. But on the other hand, if you've been through the Marriage Pact in any community, it's kind of obvious because it is such an intensely social experience.
The first time I ever experienced it was intensely social. I think that the colleges today that have Marriage Pact experience it in an intensely social way, especially after something like COVID, with what we've seen in terms of young people feeling very well connected to, you know, maybe who they are online, but in real life, I think experiencing a lot of difficulty in terms of feeling connected to a community.
Most dating experiences today happen in a very siloed environment. where it's something that you do on your own. And maybe at some point you tell your friends about a date you had, or you know, you show them a screenshot of a crazy profile that you saw. But it's not really an activity that you can't wait to do with your friends. And I think what we've seen is that you know, Marriage Pact wouldn't be complete unless you were doing it with your friends. And the majority of the reason why people sign up is because all my friends are doing it.
Marriage Pact is an algorithm created to help students meet their individual needs. But the innovativeness doesn't come from computer programming. It's the way they enhance the matchmaking experience. From a solo affair to a public event, it's a communal experience.
One thing that Liam and I talk about a lot is, why shouldn't Marriage Pact be an enduring tradition at every college community in the country? It's been so meaningful to us at Stanford and to the schools that we've been to so far.
I think there are three kinds of meaningful relationships we really hope we may serve one day. One of them is obviously your romantic relationships, right? Also your friendships, right? Your meaningful friendships, your close friends, right? What are the things that you do with them, and how do those friendships add meaning to your life? And then finally, I think one last relationship that we often forget about, which is our relationship with ourselves. You know, I think there's a piece of Marriage Pact that has to do with understanding yourself. And I think that if we could use technology to help, you know, serve those kinds of meaningful relationships, that would mean the world to us.
That's Liam McGregor of the Marriage Pact, which he co-founded with a classmate, Sophia Sterling Angus. He spoke with Kalalia, who's a producer for the New Yorker Radio Hour. When the Marriage Pact concluded at Princeton, Kalalia called up the student she met with, named Maddie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you, Maddie?
They actually released the matches during what we call here breakfast for dinner. So they like serve dinner in the dining halls from 10 to 11. At least in the dining hall that I was in, everybody was talking about it. My match, we were actually in the 98.47 percentile of all possible matches.
98.4.
So, yeah.
That's pretty high.
Yeah. She said, "Hi, full disclosure, I'm in a relationship and I participated in the Marriage Pact thing because I mostly wanted to find a like-minded person I could build a friendship with." I was like, wow, wow, this Marriage Pact thing actually really works because I'm in the same exact situation.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Okay, now picture this. Madison Square Garden, the world's greatest arena. The stands are packed. It's a sellout crowd, 20,000 people. And on the ice, the New York Rangers are valiantly looking to close out the season on what they hope will be a high note. Suddenly, there's a breakaway. The Rangers' Frank Vetrano zooms down the ice. It's just him and the opposing goalie, and he shoots, and the home crowd groans. In that moment of frustration and true grief, Ray Castaldi comes to the rescue. Castaldi is the organist at Madison Square Garden. And his music direction has everything to do with whether you're sitting in your seat or standing up and screaming your lungs out. With the Rangers now out of contention for the Stanley Cup, Castaldi gets to take some time off. And we paid him a visit recently, just as the Rangers were closing out their season.
I'm Ray Castaldi. I'm the music director for the New York Rangers at Madison Square Garden. So we're up here on the 10th floor of Madison Square Garden, really the 11th floor, because there's one more little stairwell to get up here. And we are right up by the ceiling, right up by the Ranger banners. They're hanging in front of us. You really can't get any higher and be inside the building. And we're up on this ledge, and we've got the organ here and some DJ equipment and electronic gear, and we're looking out over the ice. Oh, that was kind of cool. As if on cue, the music starts up. ...1989, different world. I was doing music in nightclubs, and I heard about the Garden from a friend of mine. He's like, you know, they're auditioning someone to play the organ. They want to bring the organ back. They need someone who can pick records, too, and mix records, as well as play the organ. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll give that a shot. And, you know, I figured I'd do it for a year or so. I really like my job is to kind of line up the energy of the fans and get them all going in the same direction and, you know, maybe get them going to a higher level than they would do on their own.
Wow. Well, they're not going to be very happy here.
Kind of like the biggest fan, right? The biggest cheerleader, right? I'm the fan that has all the loud equipment to make noise in the arena.
All right, let's keep it up, Rumor. Don't be afraid now to go for the heavy hitters.
You try to keep the energy up and keep driving them. You know, you'll hear that over the headset. Let's keep driving them. Let's keep driving them. One of the very unique things about playing at hockey games is that you can't make any sounds, any music or organ or anything while the guys are actually skating and playing hockey. And that's mostly due to safety. You know, it's a collision sport. The guys are going really fast at each other, and they need to hear what's going on around them for their own safety.
Rangers playing very physical. It's good.
But unlike other sports where you can jump in anytime you like when you feel like there's a good moment, at hockey, you can't. You got to wait. And it might be 5 seconds or it might be 3 or 4 minutes.
All right, Rumor, let's see where we're at here. Let's see where the next whistle lands us.
And, you know, you can go through a whole world of emotions in 4 minutes. So it's challenging that way, but fun. In the NBA, a lot of the buildings use recorded organ sounds. And, you know, some baseball teams do and some hockey teams do as well. And, you know, they do what they do, but emotionally they're always the same. It's a recording, so it's not going to be any different in the first period than in overtime. When you want a little bit more urgency and a little bit more emotion behind it, it's still a recording, so it's not going to do that. But there are places that use recordings, so it's live, folks.
I got it here.
For me, it's just like really fun to like look at, you know, the people that have played the organ at these sporting events in New York and wherever, you know, down through the years. Even things like just the phrasing and the pacing of things. Yeah, you know, it's this kind of like a sort of like a tradition, and a lot of the stuff is definitely like handed down and passed along. My favorite moment is when the Rangers score. And they're singing along to the goal song, and all these people are just thrilled. It's just wonderful. It sounds cliche, but I do have to pinch myself, especially when we get to, you know, a postseason tournament where you know how much people want to come to these games and want to be part of it and want to be a part of the energy. And I just get to walk right in and get my seat right up here over the ice. And, you know, kind of contribute to the madness a little bit, too. You'll hear me yelling at the team like an idiot upstairs, you know, wanting them to score and, you know, shoot the puck and everything else.
Shoot the puck! Jesus!
If you love sports and you love music, this is where you want to be. This is the job you want to have.
That's Ray Castaldi, the musical director at Madison Square Garden. Condolences to Ray and all other Ranger fans out there. As the Dodgers used to say, there's always next year. And for us, there's always next week. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele, with help from Allison McAdam, David Gable, Harrison Keithline, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Mengfei Chen.
We had additional help this week from Zach Helfand, Amy Pearl, and Michael May.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.